Esdras, king of Athens, voluntarily gave his life to ensure the salvation of his people in fulfillment of a prophecy that if he gave his life, they would be saved. And, quote, "So the Athenians, by the power of a leader offering himself to death for the salvation of the fatherland, were freed from war," end quote. The Jews embraced the same value system. The Maccabean literature, for example, includes a tale of the seven martyrs who, by giving their lives, save the land, literally atoning for the sins of Israel, and thus becoming, quote, "a ransom for the sin of our nation," end quote. In fact, Jewish use of human sacrifice as atonement magic appears several times in the Old Testament. King David resorted to human sacrifice, crucifying the sons of Saul, at the beginning of the harvest, to appease the Lord and atone for the sins of Israel, in order to persuade Jehovah to end a famine. And it worked. It might not be a coincidence that the seven sons here slain correspond to the seven sons slain in 4 Maccabees. Notably, in 2 Samuel, the atonement sacrifice occurs the day after Passover, exactly when Jesus is killed, that being the day when the barley harvest begins, the first of the harvests. A plague had similarly been lifted by Aaron and Moses by performing a human sacrifice to appease Jehovah, spearing an interracial couple and crucifying apostate leaders, an act which again atoned for the sins of Israel. In this system of understanding, the more awful and shameful the manner of death, the more heroic and powerful it was. This thinking dates at least as far back as Plato, who confronts the logic of the nihilist Glaucon in relating the legend of Gyges, who, upon acquiring a ring of invisibility, was able to do anything without detection and thus seized supreme power by murder and other sins. And so Glaucon argued, no one is really just. They only wish to seem just, because that's all that is useful. Glaucon then argues that the only way to know if a man is truly just is to take everything away from him and treat him completely as an unjust man, despised by everyone, and punished to the utmost, including torments and, finally, crucifixion. The Jewish model for the very same notion appears in the book of Job. If a man, after all this, remains just to the end, only then will we know he was a just man. Although Glaucon argues that such a man would by the end conclude justice was something not worth all that he had suffered, and therefore one ought to be unjust and, like Gyges, merely conceal one's crimes. The answer then made to Glaucon is that the gods will always know, and therefore the just will have their reward. That this misses his point is not addressed in the dialogue, illustrating that sometimes theoretical analysis in antiquity was not always very sophisticated. And in the same way, in the final analysis, Jesus' sacrifice on the cross was not awesome at all, but trivial, as he knew all along he would be resurrected and glorified, and thus he was not in fact sacrificing anything. So the fact that Christians never noticed this flaw in their logic should thus not surprise us, as Plato never noticed it either. They were as philosophically naive as he was, and remained so for nearly 2,000 years. So we cannot object to this argument by claiming they would have noticed its flaw, because they didn't. To fully understand the point, Glaucon's argument should be read in full. Quote, "The just man would be a simple and noble man who does not wish to seem, but actually be good. So we must deprive him of the seeming. For if he is going to be thought just, he will have honors and gifts because of that esteem. We cannot be sure in that case whether he is just for justice's sake or for the sake of the gifts and honors. So we must strip him bare of everything but justice, and make his state the opposite of his imagined counterpart. Though doing no wrong, he must have the repute of the greatest injustice, so that he may be put to the test as regards justice, by not softening because of this ill repute and the consequences thereof. But let him hold on his course, unchangeable, even unto death, seeming all his life to be unjust, though being just, that so both men, in other words, this man and another who gets to merely seem just, have reached the limit, the one of injustice, the other of justice, we may pass judgment which of the two is the happier. What they will say is this, that such being his disposition, the just man will have to endure the lash, the rack, chains, the branding iron in his eyes, and finally, after every extremity of suffering, he will be crucified, and so will learn his lesson that not to be, but to seem just, is what we ought to desire." End quote. This, of course, is the opposite logic embraced by the Christians. It's the kind of human wisdom, quote-unquote, the wisdom of clever words, that Paul vehemently denounces. So we can expect someone of his disposition to flip Galkon's argument upside down. If a man remained just all the way to that horrible end, all the way to the cross, and still he deemed that outcome best, then Glaucon's nihilistic reasoning would be refuted, and by his very own premises. And then Glaucon's intellectual opponents would be vindicated, as this just man is rewarded after death by God, being exalted to the highest. This completely explains the moral logic of the Christian creed that Paul repeats to the Philippians. In perfect accord with the lesson Plato was teaching in his dialogue, which lesson later became a stock element of Stoic philosophy, Jesus is given the opportunity to seize all power, quote-unquote, equality with God, just like Gyges, but unlike Gyges, Jesus rejected it, Philippians 2, verse 6, and took the other path. He became nothing, a slave to the elements, a mortal, accepting humiliation and death, even death on a cross, Philippians 2, verses 7 to 8. See also Galatians 3, verse 13. And therefore God highly exalted him, Philippians 2, verse 9. This is Plato's moral philosophy in a nutshell. This is a stock example of the just and wise man known throughout pagan philosophy. Not always accepted, but known. And among those yearning most for morality and justice, it was not just known, but admired and praised. It was therefore not a radical idea. In fact, it is simply a merging of a popular philosophical idea, the just man enduring the cross, with a popular religious idea, the suffering savior God. It was already the standard trope in all the mystery religions that it was by suffering some ordeal, often death, that the God procured salvation for his adherents. See element 31. And as we saw earlier, legendary kings and generals and martyrs readily volunteered to fulfill that role too, and they were valorized for it. In Jewish religion, the sacrificial narrative of Abraham and Isaac was a primary model, the firstborn son being sacrificed, but a substitute is made available instead, explaining why animals and not people are sacrificed to God. Thus, as Karen Finsterbusch says, quote, almost all the law codes in the Pentateuch include a law concerning sacrifice or redemption of the firstborn of humans and animals, end quote. In this matrix of reasoning, Jesus' crucifixion and atoning death was a natural extension of both Jewish and pagan traditions of human sacrifice, of beloved sons in particular, to procure salvation for the nation or kin group. Jesus' sacrifice, in fact, is based on the Isaac story, which had already been rabbinically linked with Passover. In legend, both events occur on the same day, and the Isaac narrative is explicitly represented as the original Passover in texts such as Jubilees 17 and 18. Thus, in Galatians 3 and 4, Paul links Jesus with both Isaac and the Passover lamb. And we know that Paul, and later Christians, explicitly linked Christ's death with the Passover sacrifice. The connections with the Isaac narrative are more obvious. The connections with the Passover narrative appear by allusion in Paul's slavery and freedom metaphor, in the contrast made between Sinai and Jerusalem, and being saved because you are known by God, just as the Israelites are known by the Lord and thus passed over. Both narratives involve substitutionary sacrifice, but the Jesus sacrifice reverses the Isaac sacrifice. In the Isaac story, in place of the singular sacrifice of Abraham's beloved firstborn son, animals must be slain every year in perpetuity. The one equals the other. Logically, therefore, a singular sacrifice of God's beloved firstborn son would be a sufficient substitute for all animal sacrifices in perpetuity. Therefore, if you wanted to be rid of those animal sacrifices, in other words, if you wanted to be rid of the otherwise divinely ordained temple cult and all the corrupt political and economic powers that controlled it, as many Jews did, as we saw in element 28, logic would compel you to look for a singular human sacrifice to accomplish that. And it would have to be the most powerful sacrifice imaginable, which to any Jew would be the sacrifice of God's firstborn son, which we've already seen some Jews already believed existed, as in element 40, and was already named Jesus, as in element 6. The problem of the temple cult that the Jews faced, therefore entailed a solution that is essentially the core teaching of Christianity. It would therefore not be a wholly radical step for any Jew to propose that solution, but in fact entirely in accord with much Jewish thinking at the time. As John Levinson says, quote, "If Jesus is the true Isaac, and the church is the body of Jesus," end quote, as Paul argues, then, quote, "it follows that the church must see itself in the role of Isaac, that is, as the promised son of the freeborn woman," end quote, in Galatians 4. Jesus, therefore, is the lamb substituted for Isaac, thereby sparing Isaac, in other words, the church. Thus, the salvation logic of earliest Christianity made perfect sense within the Jewish worldview, no matter which way one looked at it. Section 3. Elements of Literary Context. Element 44. In Jewish and pagan antiquity, in matters of religious persuasion, fabricating stories was the norm, not the exception, even in production of narratives purporting to be true. In fact, the persuasive power of representing a story as true was precisely why fabricated stories were often represented as true. We therefore must approach all ancient religious literature from an assumption of doubt, and must work to confirm any given story or account as true, not the other way around, because prior probability always favors fabrication in that genre. That this is true becomes obvious the moment all ancient religious literature is examined together as a complete set. The number of fictional treatises posing as factual in that set is vast. The number of honest factual narratives is comparatively few. This is already provable from Christian literature alone, but first I will focus on Jewish and pagan literature, in other words, everything besides Christian literature, in order to establish the literary context in which Christian literature must be understood. Then I will show how Christian literature fits exactly the same trend. First, the Jewish Apocrypha. Even the Maccabean literature contains a lot that is dubious and is hardly trusted as more than historical fiction. But collections like the Enochic literature are obvious wholesale fabrication. The fictionality of the Enochic literature is self-evident. On the Maccabean literature as historical fiction, see Sarah Raup Johnson's book, Historical Fictions and Hellenistic Jewish Identity. In fact, Johnson concludes, not only is, quote, "the historical truth of the events," end quote, recorded in 3 Maccabees, quote-unquote, "simply irrelevant" to its author, except insofar as to make his story seem true, but the, quote, "juxtaposition of history and fiction, combining historical verisimilitude with a remarkable disregard for historical accuracy, is characteristic of a wide variety of Jewish Hellenistic texts," end quote. The Book of Tobit, the Ascension of Isaiah, the Revelation of Moses, and countless other Revelation texts, the Jews invented a vast library of apocalyptic literature. Joseph and Aseneth, the Testimonies of the 12 Patriarchs, the Haggadic Midrashim, such as, but not only, the Midrash Rabbah, are all fiction posing as fact. And that's pretty much the whole of Jewish faith literature. It's long been known that most of the Old Testament is fiction. Exodus, Job, Ruth. Or forgery. Daniel, Deutero-Isaiah, Deutero-Zechariah. Indeed, it's not like any non-fundamentalist scholar thinks that Elijah-Elisha narrative in the King's literature is more than minutely factual at best, as if anyone actually had reliable sources for any of it. In fact, most of it is probably complete fabrication, stories added century after century as new points needed to be made, as has been noted by Suzanne Otto in the June 2003 issue of the Journal for the Study of the Old Testament. Likewise, Philo's biographies of biblical characters, for example, Life of Moses, On Joseph, etc., or stories added or perhaps even invented by Josephus about them in the Jewish Antiquities. One of the most astonishing examples is the first century collection called the Biblical Antiquities, once attributed to Philo, but whose actual authors are unknown. This is basically a whole second Bible, in which often minor characters in the Old Testament are picked out and given embellished background stories and adventures, none of which based on a lick of fact. This is essentially identical to what Philo and Josephus do for the more famous figures, and so, too, the Haggadic Midrashim, from the Midrash Rabbah to the often wild legends scattered throughout the Talmud, not just about biblical characters, but about rabbis as well, only some of which are likely to be true. It's all of the same piece. This is what Jewish faith literature looked like. Fake stories passed off as fact. That was the norm. This was equally true of pagan faith literature. Already, we partly explored this in Element 14. Of course, the so-called novels were all religious narratives, and they do not actually say they are fiction, as were all the tragedies dramatizing mythology, and even some comedies poking fun at religion. Yet all these texts were fiction. The entire corpus of mythology, stories of gods, heroes, and sages, and paradoxography, collections of incredible tales, in antiquity, was certainly not based in fact, hardly at all. Yet these were the standard modes of writing faith literature in pagan cultures. In Hebrew culture, the standard model for the same thing was the historical narrative. Exodus, Daniel, Ruth, Job, the Elijah-Elisha narrative in 1 and 2 Kings. This was what Jewish mythology looked like, which is why it is fallacious to assume all mythology looks the way Greeks and Romans wrote it, since every culture has its own way of composing its myths. But myths they are, and the models can even change over time. As pagan literature came to revere the historical narrative as well, the trend of representing mythology in poetry and drama began to decline, and in its place arose a new trend of representing mythology in prose history and biography, which looked exactly like actual history and biography, yet was complete fabrication. A classic example of this trend is seen in the phenomenon of euhemerization. Thus, lives of non-historical demigods were written as if they actually existed and could be placed in history, and one could argue about which stories about them were true or which false, even though in fact they never existed at all, and so all the stories about them were false. A good example of this is Plutarch's biography of Romulus. This was a Roman adoption of a Greek demigod who later was associated with some of the founding legends of the Roman people, his Greek origins by then completely forgotten. Yet Plutarch saw fit to write a straightforward historical biography about him, in which he ponders what stories are true and what false, and includes this alongside biographies of actual persons, such as Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar, written in exactly the same style. In the same fashion, historians like Livy or Dionysius would include mythological figures in their otherwise straightforward histories as if they actually existed. In fact, representing myth as fact became so popular, a trend arose of inventing sources to cite as one's authorities, thus completing the representation that myths were actual histories. This is how myth began to look under the Roman Empire. When we collect all of this pagan faith literature together, we see exactly the same outcome. Almost all of it is fabricated, yet passed off as true. This was the norm. Even outside faith literature, standards and practices were not as we would wish them to be. What were represented as sober histories were not consistently honest or reliable. A good story often trumped any interest in what actually happened. And speeches and sayings were routinely invented for historical figures, and obviously for non-historical figures as well, based on the reasoning that it's what they must have said, or, of course, what an author wants them to have said. Much of the development in the gospel tradition exemplifies this, but it's evident also in the Jewish Apocrypha and even the later Jewish canon. Deuteronomy was not written by Moses, nor were the words in it spoken by either him or God, and Daniel is likewise a total fabrication. Pagans, not embracing the same concept of authoritative scripture, had less pressing need to attribute sayings to authorities in this way, although they did so. This is almost certainly the case for the many collections of sayings attributed to particular sages in Diogenes Laertius's Lives of Eminent Philosophers in the first half of Book 1. But it is most clearly exemplified in the practice of forgery, attempting to give authority to a system of statements by attributing them to a respected philosopher such as Aristotle or scientist such as Galen. Letters were similarly forged often enough to become their own genre, as were fake histories and documents of all kinds. So when Christians started doing the same, they were taking up a venerable tradition. Finally, the most startling example of this problem is that the standard method of constructing biographies of revered men was intrinsically fabricatory. A great deal of ancient biography, even of real people, was constructed of myth and fiction, frequently telescoping things a person said or wrote into entire fake stories about things they did or that were done to them, even in the most incredible ways. This has been shown for the ancient biographies of historical poets and philosophers, whose entire biographies are almost wholly made up, based loosely on their writings rather than any kind of biographical sources. For example, Euripides' marital troubles were invented based on things different characters say about marriage in his plays, and not on anything that had anything to do with the actual Euripides or sources about his life. Most biographies of philosophers and poets in antiquity were of this type, inventions passed off as facts. And in the case of non-existent persons, like Romulus or Moses, this was again the norm. They would get complete biographies, with origins and deaths and adventures and quips and teachings and family and friends, including siblings with names, a hometown, the whole shebang. All invented. There was nothing exceptional or unusual about this at all. This is what typically happened. It therefore cannot be regarded as improbable. Thus, we must heed and can now understand the serious force of the words of James Crossley on this matter. Quote, "People could in fact create stories grounded in lives of figures who may have been deemed historical actors who really did live, breathe, and die, for example, Jubilees, Genesis Apocryphon, Joseph and Aseneth, Midrashic and Haggadic literature, etc. Yet such stories could hardly be said to give genuine historical insight as to what really happened millennia ago when Moses was supposed to receive the law, when Abram went down to Egypt, or when Joseph wed Aseneth, etc., if indeed these events did happen. To give another particularly relevant example, the traditions surrounding the Book of Esther are chaotic, going off in all kinds of directions that are frequently contradictory. These are not assimilated into one Jewish theology, and the inconsistencies are not the reason they are assumed to be historically inaccurate. But historically inaccurate they are, and it is hardly going too far to assume something similar was happening in the gospel traditions, a point that should not have to be made. Moreover, these Jewish stories continue to have a powerful emotive effect and needed to be defended in the light of different contexts." End quote. Thus, Crossley concedes, people often invented these things because they needed to believe them, or needed others to believe them, and therefore had to represent them as factual. This is obvious in, quote, "the expanded Jewish stories of, for example, Moses, Abraham, Joseph, Elijah, and numerous rabbis," end quote. In some cases, the reasons for fabrication are unclear, seeming only to make great heroes seem greater, or to tell stories through them that then carried more telling weight, or simply because it sounded right. But many examples, quote, "which cannot be historically accurate, rewrite stories of figures in the past to justify a belief in the present," end quote. Indeed, that was a routine practice. Hence, quote, "it follows that it is perfectly possible for the gospel writers to do the same," end quote. They are certainly in the same boat, because often, quote, "historically inaccurate storytelling was done for fairly recent figures, too," end quote. Quote, "stories of rabbis are one example, and another is the rapid emergence of miraculous and legendary traditions surrounding pagan figures such as Alexander or Augustus, even within their own lifetimes," end quote. Thus, Crossley concludes, quote, "it should seem blindingly obvious that people invent stories, and the sifting of fact from fiction, or fiction from fact, has been one of the most notable features in the history of critical biblical scholarship. So if we are going to take Christianity seriously in its Jewish and pagan contexts, then we must expect the gospel writers to make up stories just as Jews and pagans did. Historically speaking, it is extremely unlikely that the Christians behind the gospel traditions were immune to this standard practice," end quote. He is entirely correct. In fact, our conclusion must be even stronger than this. For when we look at all faith literature together, most of it, by far, was fabricated to a great extent, and most was fabricated in its entirety. This leaves us with a very high prior probability that Christian literature will be the same. And we can confirm this to be the case. If we exclude devotional and analytical literature, for example, apologies, commentaries, instructionals, hymnals, and only focus on primary source documents about earliest Christianity, we find that most Christian faith literature in its first three centuries is fabricated, indeed, most by far. We'll see some examples in chapter 8, but the most obvious category is the Christian Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. Hundreds of forged documents, from faked letters of Paul to Seneca, to faked letters of Clement of Rome, and by that I mean beyond one Clement, if that is even authentic. More faked letters from Peter and Paul than are even in the New Testament, for example, 3 Corinthians, 3 and 4 Peter, and so on. and it is a fact that there are already forged letters in the New Testament, as we'll see in chapter 7. Even faked letters from Jesus, several in Revelation already, another from Jesus to Abgar, is reproduced in Eusebius. And fabricated Gospels and Acts and Apocalypses, far outnumbering the canonical ones, as well as countless legends and tales passed off as fact, in the commentaries of Papias and Hegesippus, as we'll see in chapter 8. And countless other fictions, the Epistle of Barnabas, for example, or the Decree of Tiberius, cited as authoritative proof that Emperor Tiberius converted to Christianity. There were in fact over 40 different Gospels written, of which even fundamentalists agree only the canonical four are in any way authentic, while most mainstream scholars entertain the possibility that only one or two of those are at best. Plus over half a dozen different Acts. Among the other Acts are the Acts of Peter, Acts of Philip, Acts of John, Acts of Paul, Acts of Thomas, Acts of Pilate, and the Acts of Andrew. Note that if we are to presume that 4 out of 40 Gospels were authentic, then the prior probability that any specific Gospel is authentic will be only 1 in 10 at best. For any given Acts, those chances are 1 in 8. In other words, probably not. Examples of this fabricatory activity in early Christian faith literature are vast in quantity. This was clearly the norm, not the exception. Most of what Christians wrote were lies. We therefore should approach everything they wrote with distrust. Element 45. A popular version of this phenomenon in ancient faith literature was the practice of euhemerization, the taking of a cosmic god and placing him at a definite point in history as an actual person who was later deified. We already noted Plutarch's criticism of the trend, which he frowns upon, but in so doing concedes its popularity, in Element 14. Euhemerus was a Greek writer of the early 3rd century BC, who wrote a book called The Sacred Scriptures, in which he depicted an imaginary scholar discovering that Zeus and Uranus were once actual kings. In the process, Euhemerus invents a history for these god-kings, even though we know there is no plausible case to be made that either Zeus or Uranus was ever a real person. Yet the idea caught on. Biographies and histories of non-existent people proliferated, and ancient literature flowered with attempts to assign mythic heroes and gods to real historical periods and places. Even before that, there were attempts to develop a historical Hercules to justify territorial disputes in the Peloponnesus. And afterwards, the origin of Rome was explained by appealing to an eponymous godman named Romulus. And many other uses were found for the procedure, as we saw for inventing King Arthur, Ned Ludd, Abraham, Moses, and other national heroes that I explored in Chapter 1. There was nothing at all unusual about doing this. Element 46. Ancient literature also proliferated a variety of model hero narratives, some of which the Gospel Jesus conforms to as well, and one of these hero types was widely revered among pagans, the pre-Christian narratives of the life and death of Socrates and Aesop. These match those of Jesus in the following respects. 1. They all came from a humble background. Socrates was the son of a stonemason. Aesop was a slave. 2. Yet all were exalted as a moral hero and an exemplary man, who was in the right, and whose teachings one ought to follow. 3. And that despite all of them having opposed and denounced the established religious authorities and having challenged the received wisdom of their people. 4. All attacked the sin and greed of the religious and political elite. 5. All attended the parties of sinners and ate and drank with them. 6. Yet all consistently denounced sinners and sought to reform them. 7. All taught with questions, parables, and paradoxes. 8. All taught to love truth, despise money, and have compassion on others. 9. All taught that they wanted to save everyone's soul. 10. All were despised by some and beloved by others for their teachings. 11. All were publicly mocked in some way. 12. All were renowned to be physically ugly or deformed. 13. All were executed by the state for blasphemy, a crime they did not commit. 14. All were actually executed for speaking against the sin and greed of the authorities. 15. All voluntarily went to their deaths, despite all having had the power to escape. 16. All prophesied God's wrath would befall their killers, and all were right. 17. All were subsequently revered as martyrs. And 18. All at the outset had been given a gift of the Spirit from God. Aesop was given a spirit that gave him a supernatural power of speaking. Socrates was given a spirit that spoke to him and counseled him toward wisdom. And Jesus, of course, was given the Holy Spirit. The fact that this was a recognized and widely revered hero narrative puts the lie to any claim that Christians were in any way radical in conforming their Jesus to it. In fact, even if Jesus existed, we still must worry about how much of his narrative is being forced into this model for that very reason, and therefore still not historically true. We can add to all this that, as Emily Wilson says, quote, Socrates, like Jesus, turned the other cheek and forgave the enemies who had caused his death, end quote. We can likewise add that Aesop and Jesus were both itinerant preachers in a peripheral region who ended up in a central holy city and were both plotted against and executed by its priests. Delphi for Aesop, Jerusalem for Jesus. Likewise for Aesop, a quote-unquote gospel was written about his birth, life, teachings, and death, and many different redactions were then made of it, just as happened for Jesus. We've also noted already the connections between the gospel Jesus and the cynics, as in element 32. It is therefore significant that Socrates was the spiritual founder of the cynics, Diogenes the cynic having been the student of one of Socrates' pupils, Antisthenes, and cynicism remaining more faithful to the original teachings of Socrates than any other subsequent sect, including Platonism, and Diogenes, in fact, believing this was the case. And Aesop fulfilled in his life and death many of the values espoused by Socrates and the cynics. It is therefore not likely an accident that a Jewish religion espousing values well in tune with the cynics would revere as their founding hero someone who corresponds exactly to the Aesop-Socratic dying hero type that was also promoted and revered by the cynics. Socrates, we can be certain, was a historical person, as we'll see in chapter 8. But Aesop is not likely to have been. There is no strong evidence that Aesop ever actually lived. He is supposed to have flourished in the 7th century BC, much less wrote the fables attributed to him. All references to him are centuries late and based on legendary assumptions that stem from his later faith narrative, not contemporary documents or witnesses. The best case for his historicity is attempted by Nicoleta Canavu, but even she is uncertain of the strength of her case, and she overlooks the fact that her only real argument, that Aesop was a common Thracian slave name, could in fact be how the mythic name was assigned to previously anonymous fables. A common slave type was drawn up, assigned a common slave name, assigned to the fables, and then a biography built up around the figure thus created. So the fact remains we can't establish that he existed or wrote the fables attributed to him. But even if either is true, the biographies written about him are still unlikely to have any basis in fact, and no historian today believes they are. Aesop was more likely invented to place a name to a growing collection of fables passed down from numerous oral sources. Historical facts were then invented about him, and then detailed biographies were written, in some respects similar to the Gospels. If that's what happened, then Aesop would be an example of a mythical person who became the historical author of a collection of parables he didn't in fact write, which are often similar in moral and symbolic purpose to the parables of Jesus, and then about whom fictional biographies were written, which were then passed off as fact. It's easy to see how this could happen for Aesop, so in principle the same could have happened for Jesus. Element 47. Another model hero narrative, which pagans also revered and to which the gospel Jesus also conforms, is the apotheosis or ascension to godhood tale. And of these, the one to which the gospels and acts most conform is that of the Roman national hero Romulus. I discussed this already in chapter 4, and the points made there should be considered a component of the element here. The more general point is that this narrative concept of a translation to heaven for a hero, often but not always a divine son of God, was very commonplace and always centered around a peculiar fable about the disappearance of their body. All these fables were different from one another, and therefore those differences are irrelevant to the point. all still shared the same core features. Just revisit my discussion of how syncretism actually works in Element 11. And when it comes to the Romulus fable in particular, the evidence is unmistakable that Christianity conformed itself to it relatively quickly, even if all these attributes were accumulated over time and not all at once. Romulus, of course, did not exist. He was invented, along with legends about him, largely put together from previous Greek and Etruscan mythology, much later in Roman history than he is supposed to have lived. His name was eponymous, essentially an early form of the word Roman, and his story was meant to exemplify ideal Roman aspirations and values, using a model similar to Greek tragedy, in which the hero sins in various ways, but comes to self-understanding and achieves peace by the time of his death. He otherwise exhibits in his deeds the exemplary qualities of Rome as a social entity, held up as a model for Roman leaders to emulate, such as ending the cycle of violence initiated by his sin and pride by religiously expiating the sin of past national crimes in order to bring about a lasting peace. His successor, Numa, then exemplified the role of the ideal sinless king, a religious man and performer of miracles whose tomb was found empty after his death, demonstrating that he too, like his predecessor Romulus, rose from the dead and ascended to heaven. The idea of the translation to heaven of the body of a divine king was therefore adaptable and flexible, every myth being in various ways different, but in certain core respects the same. But the Gospels conform to the Romulus model most specifically. There are 20 parallels, although not every story contained every one. In some cases, that may simply be the result of selection or abbreviation in the sources we have, and therefore the silence of one source does not entail the element did not then exist or was not known to that author. And in some cases, elements might have been deliberately removed or even reversed by an author who wanted to promote a different message, as we'll see in Chapter 10 of how myth-making operated in antiquity. For example, the radiant resurrection body, probably the earlier version of Christian appearance narratives, was later transformed into a hidden god narrative, another common trope both in paganism and Judaism, as suited any given author. But when taken all together, the Romulus and Jesus death and resurrection narratives contain all of the following parallels. 1. The hero is a son of God. 2. His death is accompanied by prodigies. 3. The land is covered in darkness. 4. The hero's corpse goes missing. 5. The hero receives a new immortal body superior to the one he had. 6. His resurrection body has on occasion a bright and shining appearance. 7. After his resurrection, he meets with a follower on a road from the city. 8. A speech is given from a summit or high place prior to ascending. 9. An inspired message of resurrection or translation to heaven is delivered to a witness. 10. There is a great commission, an instruction to future followers. 11. The hero physically ascends to heaven in his new divine body. 12. He is taken up into a cloud. 13. There is an explicit role given to eyewitness testimony, even naming the witnesses. 14. Witnesses are frightened by his appearance and/or disappearance. 15. Some witnesses flee. 16. Claims are made of dubious alternative accounts, which claims were obviously fabricated for Romulus, there never having been a true account to begin with. 17. All of this occurs outside of a nearby but central city. 18. His followers are initially in sorrow over the hero's death. 19. But his post-resurrection story leads to eventual belief, homage, and rejoicing. 20. The hero is deified and cults subsequently paid to him, in the same manner as a god. Romulus, of course, was also unjustly killed by the authorities, and came from a humble background, beginning his career as an orphan and a shepherd, a nobody from the hill country, and thus also overlaps the Aesop-Socratic type, as we saw in Element 46. And it's easy to see that by combining the two, we end up with pretty much the Christian gospel in outline, especially when we appropriately Judaize the result, as we see in Elements 3-7, 17-20, and 39-43. Some of the parallels could be coincidental. For example, resurrected bodies being associated with radiance was itself a common trope, both within Judaism and paganism. But for all of them to be coincidental is extremely improbable. A mathematical objection is sometimes raised here, using the Lincoln-Kennedy coincidences as a counterexample. The reasoning being that, clearly there is no causal relation in that case, therefore large lists of coincidences can occur by chance, an example of the multiple comparisons fallacy. However, this is an invalid analogy for two reasons. First, the coincidences in the Lincoln-Kennedy case are all trivial and meaningless, and most have no conceptual connection with each other. Moreover, some are actually false. The number of true coincidences is only 15. Second, the amount of available data on Lincoln and Kennedy is vast compared to that on Romulus and Jesus or any other ancient person, mythical or historical, due to the enormous disparity in survival of sources and documents from the two periods. Combine those two conditions, and the likelihood of a long list of parallels occurring purely by chance is high, since no rules govern which parallels count, and there are so many data points, so the frequency of random parallels is high. But when neither condition obtains, the frequency is not high. In the Romulus-Jesus case, the probability is extremely low that the filter destroying almost all data about them would just by coincidence preserve 20 meaningful and substantial parallels conceptually connected to each of their death and resurrection accounts. The Lincoln-Kennedy coincidences, for example, are often highly likely to occur between any two people. Millions of people have the same number of letters in their name, for example. Whereas the Romulus-Jesus parallels are not. How many people are hailed the Son of God? How many have the world covered by a supernatural darkness at their deaths? How many have their corpses conspicuously vanish? How many visit their friends on the road from their city in a resurrected body to commission them to spread their gospel? And so on. Thus, even with a large database, 20 such parallels would be unlikely. It is only the more so with so small a database. Most of the Lincoln-Kennedy coincidences have, again, no conceptual connection to each other. What has the year of a man's birth to do with the nature of his death? But the Romulus-Jesus parallels do. All relate to describing the narratives of their deaths, and the religious aftermath directly connected thereto. Thus, the ability to find connected data points unconstrained by any parameters does not obtain in the latter case, greatly reducing the probability of even trivial parallels, much less substantial ones. For example, if I get to count any coincidences between two people, I can always find some. But if I am required to find only coincidences pertaining to the accounts of their death, not so much, except insofar as I am counting things that are frequently true of deaths in general, but none of the Romulus-Jesus parallels are such. When we get to the next element, element 48, the probability of coincidence as explanation plummets, as to get many parallels between any two people is one thing. But to find them across a dozen people is wholly another. And yet in that instance, the fact that the probability is extremely low won't even matter, as I'll explain in chapter 6. So when we look at it this way, the Christian conception of Jesus' death and resurrection appears to have been significantly influenced by the Roman conception of Romulus's death and resurrection. Even if we discount that for any reason, the Romulus parallels definitely establish that all these components were already part of a recognized hero type, and are therefore not surprising or unusual or unexpected. The story of Jesus would have looked familiar, not only in the same way all translation stories look familiar, even when different in many and profound ways, but also in the very specific way that among all such tales, it looked the most like the story of Romulus, which was publicly acted out in passion plays every year. And this was the national founding hero of the Roman Empire. What better God's tale to emulate or co-opt? Element 48. Finally, the most ubiquitous model hero narrative, which pagans also revered and to which the Gospel Jesus also conforms, is the fable of the divine king, what I call the rank raglan hero type, based on the two scholars who discovered and described it, Otto Rank and Lord Raglan. This is a hero type found repeated across at least 15 known mythic heroes, including Jesus, if we count only those who clearly meet more than half of the designated parallels, which means 12 or more matches out of 22 elements, which requirement eliminates many historical persons, such as Alexander the Great or Caesar Augustus, who accumulated many elements of this hero type in the tales told of them, yet not that many. The 22 features distinctive of this hero type are 1. The hero's mother is a virgin. 2. His father is a king or the heir of a king. 3. The circumstances of his conception are unusual. 4. He is reputed to be the son of a god. 5. An attempt is made to kill him when he is a baby. 6. To escape which, he is spirited away from those trying to kill him. 7. He is reared in a foreign country by one or more foster parents. 8. We are told nothing of his childhood. 9. On reaching manhood, he returns to his future kingdom. 10. He is crowned, hailed, or becomes king. 11. He reigns uneventfully, that is, without wars or national catastrophes. 12. He prescribes laws. 13. He then loses favor with the gods or his subjects. 14. He is driven from the throne or city. 15. He meets with a mysterious death. 16. He dies atop a hill or high place. 17. His children, if any, do not succeed him. 18. His body turns up missing. 19. Yet he still has one or more holy sepulchres, in fact or fiction. 20. Before taking a throne or wife, he battles and defeats a great adversary, such as a king, giant, dragon, or wild beast. And 21. His parents are related to each other. And 22. He marries a queen or princess related to his predecessor. Many of the heroes who fulfill this type also either performed miracles in life or as a deity after death, or were pre-existent beings who became incarnated as men, or subsequently worshipped as savior gods, any one of which honestly should be counted as a 23rd attribute. Unquestionable miracle workers on the following list are Moses, Jesus, Theseus, who returned from the dead to fight supernaturally in wartime, Dionysus, Hercules, apart from his own supernatural feats in life, as a deity he answered prayers, Zeus, Osiris, and Asclepius. The latter three were celebrated miracle-bringing gods. Which already is more than half the list, 8 in all. Others on the rank Raglan list may also have miracle legends associated with them. Of these qualifying features, Jesus shares all three. Likewise, many who fit this hero type fulfilled prophecy, and although that was commonly the case for heroes generally, far beyond the specific hero type described here, it is another feature Jesus shares in common with them, and which honestly should be counted as a 24th attribute. I thank Lauren Petrich and Aaron Adair for pointing this out and providing research confirming it. Those who share this element would include, besides obviously Jesus, Moses, Oedipus, Perseus, Theseus, Jason, Pelops, and Hercules, which is again more than half the list, 9 in all. It is entirely possible others on the rank Raglan list also met this criterion. But I shall work from the traditional 22. The 15 people who score more than half of those 22 features, in order of how many they score, from most to least, is as follows. And these scores are taken from Siegel, except the scoring for Osiris is my own, based on the information in Plutarch's On Isis and Osiris. And I have reduced some scores based on my own examination of the evidence, since applying the criteria must be reasonably rigorous to be meaningful, as I noted for the Lincoln-Kennedy case. With more precise wording of the criteria and more careful scoring, the following is what we end up with. Number 1 is Oedipus, scoring 21 out of 22. Number 2 is Moses, scoring 20 out of 22. Number 3 is Jesus, scoring 20 out of 22. Number 4, Theseus, scoring 19 out of 22. Number 5, Dionysus, scoring 19 out of 22. Number 6 is Romulus, scoring 18 out of 22. Number 7 is Perseus, scoring 17 out of 22. Number 8 is Hercules, also scoring 17 out of 22. Number 9 is Zeus, scoring 15 out of 22. Number 10, Bellerophon, scoring 14 out of 22. Number 11, Jason, scoring 14 out of 22. Number 12, Osiris, scoring 14 out of 22. Number 13, Pelops, scoring 13 out of 22. And number 14 is Asclepius, scoring 12 out of 22. And number 15 is Joseph, that is, the son of Jacob, scoring 12 out of 22. This is a useful discovery, because with so many matching persons, it doesn't matter what the probability is of scoring more than half on the rank Raglan scale by chance coincidence. Because even if it can happen often by chance coincidence, then the percentage of persons who score that high should match the ratio of real persons to mythical persons. In other words, if a real person can have the same elements associated with them, and in particular so many elements, and for this purpose it doesn't matter whether they actually occurred, then there should be many real persons on the list, as surely there are far more real persons than mythical ones. The number of real persons in the course of antiquity must number in the hundreds of millions, whereas the number of mythical persons invented over that same course of time will be in the thousands at most. Certainly, by any calculation, the latter could not possibly outnumber the former, and even if they were equally numerous, then half the names on the list should be actual persons. But this is not the case. No known historical persons are on the list. Only mythical people ever got fitted to this hero type. For Moses and Joseph, see any current reference, such as the book The Bible Unearthed. The others hardly need a reference. They've been recognized as mythical throughout the last century of classical scholarship. Any inquiry into their origins ends the same. They began as deities long before they were translated into men and placed into histories, for example, Hercules, Dionysus, Osiris. Or they began as heroic characters in absurdist supernatural dramas that have no plausible claim to historicity, for example, Jason, Perseus, Bellerophon. When it comes to historical persons, it's the other way around. Alexander the Great and Mithridates of Pontus are the only historical figures who come close, Alexander scoring items 2 through 4, 9 and 10, 12, 16 through 17, and 22, for only 10 points. Mithridates scores items 1 and 2, 10, 12 through 14, 16 and 17, 20 and 22, for likewise 10. They can only be grossly overscored by an inappropriately loose assignment of criteria. One might propose Alexander rates 13, for example, by scoring items 13, 15, and 18, but Alexander only dealt with occasionally disobedient troops, assassins, and rebellions by conquered peoples, and he was never in any significant way abandoned by the gods or the Macedonians. His cause of death was disputed, not mysterious, and it involved nothing supernatural. His body didn't vanish, but was taken to Egypt by his general Ptolemy, where it remained to be viewed for centuries. And in the same respect, contra Adrian Mayer, stories of attempts to assassinate Mithridates during his childhood and teen years do not correspond to attempting to kill him as a baby, and at once disqualify him from the criterion that we are told nothing of his childhood. He was also not explicitly identified as the son of a god. There is no actual evidence his parents were related. A comet corresponding with his conception and birth does not relate to how he was conceived. He was not actually spirited away as a baby or raised in a foreign land, but merely traveled his own land incognito as a teen. Having never left his kingdom as a child, he can't have returned to it. Wars during his reign disqualify him from reigns uneventfully, and do not correlate with battling a single great foe before ascending his throne. There was nothing actually mysterious or supernatural about his death. His body never vanishes, and not having vanished, his body can't yet still have a tomb. It is simply then just entombed. So again, when we look at the mythical type, only mythical people ever got fitted to that type. Yet, every single one of them was regarded as a historical person and placed in history in narratives written about them. Therefore, whether fitting more than half the rank Raglan criteria was always a product of chance coincidence or the product of causal influence, either way, we can still conclude that it would be very unusual for any historical person to fit more than half the rank Raglan criteria, because if it were not unusual, then many historical persons would have done so, but not even one did. We might not know the cause of this fact, but a fact it is nonetheless, and a fact we can make use of, as I will in the next chapter. Jesus scores 20 out of 22, according to Matthew's Gospel, and whether these attributes were original or lately appended to his legend won't matter. But note that, even in Mark's Gospel, Jesus scores a 14, and even that would place him well above the bottom of the list. The first 19 hardly require defense. For example, his father is the heir of King David. He is seized by the authorities, abandoned by his followers, and driven from Jerusalem to his execution. Strange things do happen at his death, and the death itself is a strangely sudden expiration. He dies atop the hill named Golgotha, and so on. Note that crucifixion was supposed to take days to kill, thus Jesus' rapid death is itself mysterious. Even Pilate is surprised by it, and the centurion amazed by it. It is also accompanied by an abundance of prodigies, establishing it as mysterious and supernaturally potent. The remaining hit, number 20, may not be as obvious, but he scores it. Just as Oedipus confronts and defeats the riddling Sphinx, Jesus confronts and defeats the temptations of the devil, also known as the adversary, and as a serpent or dragon and prince of the world, in both cases before going to claim their kingdom. Of course, even in earliest Christian tradition, Satan is the power whom Jesus most decisively defeats so as to effect the salvation of the faithful ever after. The only two elements Jesus does not score are the last I've listed. We cannot establish number 21, that his parents were originally imagined as related, or 22, that he ever married, much less the daughter of his predecessor. However, the peculiar absence of that last element practically advertises the fact that he does merit that element allegorically. From the earliest time, Jesus was imagined to have taken the church as his bride, which was indeed understood to be the daughter of his predecessor, the nation of Israel. So in all honesty, we could assign him that element as well. But as it is not literal, I will leave his score at 20. Nevertheless, even then, he is nearly the highest scoring person in history, next only to Oedipus. And if we granted that last element, he would be tied even with him for the highest score. Attempts to deny this always devolve into specious apologetics. For example, in Richard Horsley's The Liberation of Christmas, it is claimed Jesus can't be considered a king because, quote, Jesus explicitly refuses to become a king, end quote. No citation is given for that assertion, and it ignores Matthew 2 verse 2, 21 verse 5, 25 verse 34, 27 verse 11, 29, 37, 42. This is simply denialism. Horsley's other rejections of the Raglan criteria are similarly baseless, and yet even he concedes Matthew's nativity account corresponds to the rank hero type. Jesus might even have outranked Oedipus. A later tradition held that indeed his parents were relatives, and it is possible that had been a tradition from very early on that just wasn't recorded in our Gospels. The Protoevangelion of James explicitly says Mary is, like Joseph, a descendant of David. However, by the time we hear of this detail, Jesus was being transformed into a different character. For example, infancy Gospels were then being written about him, introducing narratives of his childhood. If we scored on attributes all the way into the late 2nd century, this would remove one element, that we hear nothing of his childhood, and add another, that his parents were related to each other, keeping his score the same. It is sometimes suggested that Luke's introduction of Jesus after his 12th year counts as a narrative from his childhood, in Luke 2 verses 40-42, but that is most likely intended to be the eve of his bar mitzvah, or its ancient equivalent, which would have occurred upon his 13th birthday, the end of his 12th year, and thus is actually a story about introducing him as a man. But counting this as a story of his childhood anyway would still only reduce his score from 20 to 19. By contrast, Luke has Mary connected by family to a priest and a daughter of Aaron, and includes two men named Levi in the ancestry of Joseph, which could imply both were descendants of Levi and therefore relatives. In fact, since the infancy Gospels clearly are discordant with the early mythology of Jesus and are an entirely new phenomenon, whereas the possibility of his parents being related might actually have been imagined much earlier, he might have scored the full 22 points, making him a better fit for the rank Raglan hero type than any other man in history. And even without these assumptions, he still ranks among the highest. That is a stunning fact, which must be considered and accounted for. Section 4. Conclusion. The point of this and the previous chapter has been to summarize all the facts we must take into account as being in our total background knowledge when assigning all probabilities going forward. In my experience, a great deal of what has been surveyed up to this point remains unknown even to many experts in the study of Jesus. This is why I took the trouble to survey so much, because all of it must be taken into account by anyone who wishes to reconstruct the historical Jesus or the origins of Christianity. It is equally crucial to understanding how to evaluate and interpret the evidence for or against the historicity of Jesus, and how to estimate the prior probability of either. And to that question, I now turn. Chapter 6. The Prior Probability. Section 1. Heroes Who Never Existed. In 1945, Betty Crocker was rated in a national survey as the second most admired woman in America, and to this day a street is named after her in Golden Valley, Minnesota, where she still lives. Her father was William Crocker, a successful corporate executive in the food industry, and she started her career answering letters on cooking questions for her father's company, then acquired her own national radio show, where she delivered cooking advice for 24 years. Later, she had her own television show, while making appearances on other TV shows and in TV commercials to promote her products. I've seen actual videotapes of her cooking and speaking, and her picture still adorns various General Mills baking products. She has also published several cookbooks and now has her own website. All that is 100% true, and yet she doesn't exist. She was never born, never lived, never spoke, never appeared on TV, and never wrote a word. Others simply wrote or appeared in her name.